we're going to open an informational hearing from the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. We have Sherry Shane with us, and she's going to come up and tell us everything she knows about how she's going to create jobs in the state of Oregon. No, I'm just kidding, Sherry. Sherry, thank you for being here. You're welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sherry Shun, I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Just one minor correction. Mr. Chair said that how we are going to create jobs, in fact, businesses create jobs, and the role of government is to, in all instances, get out of the way and not be a negative, and in certain instances, be helpful and encouraging. With that, I'm going to direct your attention to the packet of information in front of you, and we'll be using this as a way to walk through some information this morning with you. I was asked to talk a little bit about the department and then provide some additional information about the focus for the department in the coming biennium. And obviously would be very pleased to answer any question and anything else you would like me to cover in the course of this presentation. If you would go to page 3 of the handout packet, it lists the department overview, and very briefly, the department has a large number of programs which we think of as tools to help businesses with job creation and retention. And rather than boring you with a lot of details about these programs, I thought it may be helpful for me to point out that some of the tools have short-term impact, meaning if we use that tool, we can expect job creation or retention within a year or two. Some of them have intermediate-term results, meaning, for example, international trade assistance or working with industry clusters. These are the kind of investment and assistance that usually will take 3 to 5 years to result in jobs. They have immediate benefit, but they don't lead to immediate job creation. And finally, we have some of the tools that really are long-term investment that may take up to 8 to 10 years to lead to job creation. And a good example would be infrastructure investment, of which the department has a huge responsibility. And you will see in the pie charts following, most of the department's resources are in that area. The short-term programs with job creation impact would be business retention and expansion assistance. We provide a lot of help to businesses that are looking to expand and need to identify sites, communities that will be able to provide the needs that they're searching for. And rather than for the company to run around the state and do their own intelligence gathering, which sometimes they choose to do in order to verify the information we provide the one-stop shop, learn what their needs are, and coordinate gathering that information from communities across Oregon that would like to participate in those opportunities. We also work with individual businesses when a business is not doing well and need to restructure some aspect of its operation. We have a program that focuses on business retention and can bring or send experts from the not from the department, but people we contract with business experience to go in, work with the business, and identify the options that may be available. In addition to working with Oregon businesses, we do now have an effort to market Oregon and get the message out that we are open for business. You might wonder about the effectiveness of this program because, especially given recent times, the news about Oregon, the financial challenge, and potentially what that means to public service and the business climate is making that a little bit difficult. But the current marketing campaign is seeing more than double the leads that we otherwise were getting, even in better times. So we do believe this is a reasonable approach to invest and continue to get the message out for businesses that are looking at Oregon. We also provide assistance to small businesses and have a number of business financing instruments for companies that are looking to expand and need access to capital. Many of these business finance programs do work through banks, so we're not always doing our own thing. Instead, we look for opportunities where possible to work with partners and plug into existing mechanisms. I would like to direct your attention to page 4. This is a quick overview of how the department is organized. As you know, the department also has partner or sister entities within the department's umbrella, and they are the Arts Commission and Oregon Tourism Commission, a total of 15 FTE. So when you adjust that 15 FTE out of the organizational chart of 147, which is where we started out at the beginning of this current biennium, that leaves the department with 132. And I just want to point out that at this point, we are officially, after five special sessions, we're at 128, and the governor's recommended budget will remove another 10-plus FTE for 0305, assuming his recommended budget or balanced budget goes through.
Did you say eliminates 10 plus?
Yes, we'll reduce the staffing by more than 10.
Chair.
Representative Gibbs.
Is that a reduction in existing staff, or is it a reduction in positions that are held? Will people lose their jobs? Or?
Yes, there will be people losing their jobs.
10?
We have, right now, we have more people than we will have positions available if we go with the governor's balanced budget. Obviously, at this point, we don't know if that's final.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mabry. Yes.
Just a question. I don't recall. I'm looking at Deputy Director and Assistant Director.
Yes.
I don't recall which you said you are. Which category do you
Representative call? Mabry, Mr. Chair, I am the Deputy Director.
Deputy Director.
Yes.
Thank you.
So if I may move forward to page 5. That's where there is some historical information comparing where the department's current resource level against previous. Let me just quickly point out a number of things. You'll see if you just looked at FTE from 87 to 91, you would have seen a fairly rapid increase. And that, as I understood, was the result of combining the community development functions of the agency with the original limited focus of the Economic Development Department. So the department started out focusing on economic development, and early on in the Economic Development Department in the late 80s, community development functions got added to it, and which then led to an increase, significant increase in staffing. But since 1991, you will see staffing has been held fairly steady. 91-93 was 130, and end of this current biennium, assuming we continue with the staffing we have now, we would be at 128, slightly below. And I had mentioned that the governor's balanced budget will further reduce that staffing. And by the way, this is just adjusted for the department, so we have taken out tourism, arts, etc. In addition, let me bring your attention to the budget bar, which is the left side of the two bars for each biennium. You'll see the lottery funds, which is the dark bar on the bottom, has changed some over the years, but it has not fluctuated in a large order of magnitude. And the 0305 governor's balanced budget does show a reasonable increase, roughly $20 million for lottery over 0103. And that is the result of $150 million of lottery bonds that were authorized by the legislature for the department to sell. I talked earlier about infrastructure investment as one example of long-term payoff of the work the department does. And that $150 million is in infrastructure investment. What does that mean? water sewer systems, financing through local jurisdictions, and community facilities, industrial parks, ports. All of those are eligible activities to be financed through our infrastructure funds. And that $150 million bonds, assuming we sell all of it, would represent $20 million in debt service, which comes out of lottery funds. So when the state issues the bonds, the state takes, in general, 15 years to pay off those bonds. And the biannual payment of the $150 million would be $20 million in lottery money. And that's what represents the increase in the dark bar. In addition, you will see the fastest growth since 1993 is the top gray, light gray section of the bar, and that's called non-limited funds. It grew in 93-95 at $318 million to 2003 at $448 million. The figure there shows the entire bar. But you'll see that the portion of the gray bar, which represents non-limited, has increased a great deal. And this non-limited fund is not something that is a direct cost to the state. It represents the payments coming back from all of these infrastructure projects that we have financed. So it, in fact, is money coming in to the state from the participating cities and other ports, other jurisdictions that finance their projects through us. But as they pay money back to the state, because it goes through the department and into a revolving loan funds from which we take from this pot to finance more projects, clearly you with budgetary oversight authority over the department need to know what is coming in and what are we doing with it, even though it's not a cost to the state. And that's why it shows in our budget, and you can see accounts for what seemed to be a growing budget for the department. In fact, a big portion of that growing total is payments coming back to the department for previously financed projects from which we revolve this loan and continue to make more loans and grants for these infrastructure projects.
Sure. Is the Special Public Works Funds within that piece of the of the bar, or is it in another part of the bar?
Mr. Chair, Special Public Works Fund is the top gray bar.
Okay.
And when we make loans from Special Public Works, which is one of the infrastructure financing programs, the money would be coming from this non-limited, the top gray bar. Most of that is money coming back into the state. However, when you authorize us to sell new lottery bonds, we also have the ability to finance a special public works project using new lottery bond, which is the instance for 0103. But in 0305, as you'll see right now, the governor's balanced budget does not recommend additional lottery bonds for the department, and therefore we'll have to resort only to those revolving loan funds resources to finance new projects.
Now we have a smaller because of the things that we did in the 01 session plus the special sessions of 02, we actually have a much more limited lottery bonding capability than we might have had otherwise. Is that correct?
As I understand, for 0305, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the state has remaining about $120 million in lottery bonding capacity that is available but not bonded. And I should say that the department is authorized to sell $150 million in lottery bonds for 0103, but so far only because we have the authority to sell, but the bonding sales actually goes through the Department of Administrative Services. And at this point, only $60 million have been sold. A remaining $90 million is scheduled to be sold at the end of the biennium. And we right now have more than half of those funds in real projects that have conditional commitment, meaning municipalities are waiting for that bonds to be issued pending their financing. So they know if the bonds are sold, they'll get the money and go ahead with the financing. If the bonds are not, then the department does not have the ability to use the revolving loan funds because that's a much lower level to finance all of those projects.
Now, Sherry, let me interrupt you one more time, if I may, and that is with regards to the rural and distressed areas. Is that also within that gray bar of the bonding capacity, or is that another piece of the pie?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department has a focus that is charged by the legislature to work with rural and distressed areas of the state. This charge came to us in the statute, and we have interpreted that as focusing our investments. And so you can see that in our total investment as well as the grants that we make will give priority to rural and distressed communities. And that applies to primarily infrastructure financing projects.
Thank you. Representative Mabry.
May I just add to that, your bullet says, greater emphasis was placed on economic development until 1997 when focus shifted to rural and distressed areas. On the surface, being from a rural area and representing a very rural area, that could be read as to say, we used to focus on economic development opportunities, now we're focusing on small and rural, which is charity. And we don't see it that way, and I'm sure that's not the way it was intended, but could you enlarge upon that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, certainly the information, the note here is just to make clear a shift in legislative direction to the agency. Certainly did not intend to suggest, I think, how it was interpreted. The reality is the department has always had two charges, economic development, immediate impact on job creation and retention, and community development, focusing on helping local jurisdictions, whether urban or rural, distressed or not distressed, with infrastructure financing needs in order for these localities to be ready for job growth when the opportunity comes. And I would say that since 1997, there has been, because the economy was very good and really job growth has not been a desirable priority in many parts of the state, I think partly that had contributed to the direction from the legislature saying focus on those parts of the state where they have not participated equally in the economic prosperity. I think the department continues to have those two mandates and continue to bring those two together in order to work to better Oregon. But that's part of the reason why I underscore the range of tools we have. Some of them have immediate results, some of them have long-term results, and when you look at the surface and when you look at the department's total budget resources, you would think it's a lot of money, but only a very small portion of that are directed toward the immediate job creation task. I just want to make sure that's clear. Thank you.
I appreciate that.
The final point I want to say about this chart is if you look at just the lottery funds, we calculated that the growth over this period has been roughly about 3% annual. So lottery resources, on the one hand, have not grown significantly. On the other hand, total resources appear to have grown a lot. And again, that's because of the loan repayments over time. Our investments are paying back and allow us to make more investments in projects. If I may direct your attention to page 6. This pie shows the total resources of the department. Just want to mention a number of things. The first one is Representative Mayberry's point about exactly sort of how do we use our monies. Roughly 10% of the monies are directed toward business retention, expansion, and recruitment. I should say the use of these monies tend to be grants, which means that once we apply those resources, we don't see them come back. However, the big part of the pie really is for water, sewer, other infrastructure financing, And those uses of funds tend to be loans. There is a small grant component to leverage the loan and make the project doable. But at the same time, over the long term, these monies do come back and make up a big part of the department's budget and gives us the ability to continue with financing these projects. We do have pass-throughs. You remember Tourism, Film and Video, and the Arts Commission are part of the OECD umbrella. And so their budget, in addition to regional rural investment, which is a pass-through program to multi-county entities, and use those resources at the regional and local level for economic development projects and other projects. And those pass-throughs make up about 12% of the department's budget. And I did subtract from the total two things. The first one is one-time pass-throughs. For example, the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project money are in the department's budget, but that is a one-time pass-through as opposed to tourism, arts, or regional rural, which are an ongoing part of the department's budget. So I took that out in order to make it more comparable to previous years. And then the second thing is something called hollow limitation, which is really the ability for the capacity that would allow higher level of spending to occur if more grants or program income becomes available. And at this point, we have backed those out because we know what realistically are the funds that we can get from federal grant sources, and those hollow limitations make the budget look inflated and much higher than they really are.
Okay.
If I may go on to page 7, the budget by fund type, you'll see, again, other funds, which is these loan repayments, make up a huge part of the department's resources. Lottery makes up 17%, a small amount of lottery carryover. These are funds that we have committed to business deals, and the entity was not able to draw upon that, but are committed from previous biennium. A very small part of the department money is general fund, and that's the Arts Commission only. And finally, federal fund makes up about 9%. If I may go on to page 8. If you look at how we use our lottery funds, more than a quarter is in debt services. I talked earlier about the authority to issue lottery bonds, which are backed by lottery revenue to pay the debt service, and that's where it shows up here, the 27%. Pass-throughs, regional rural program, tourism, and film and video office. And then finally, the 42%, roughly $27 million, is the funds paying for staffing and direct business development programs. And the final chart shows our staffing is paid with mostly lottery, the majority of the staffing, but other funds, these are the infrastructure financing programs, they do pay for the program administration needed. So, for example, Special Public Works Fund making a financing a project, the staff time spent working on the financing deal is charged to the infrastructure fund. And finally, federal makes up about 5%. I think that's probably enough numbers and statistics about the department. So let me just walk you through very quickly, what do we accomplish? I have a few graphs to show our accomplishment. The first one is wanting to make sure you know that we spread the resources and our services and assistance around Oregon. The benchmark here is 240 Oregon incorporated cities. Out of those 240, the department in this current biennium, the first 18 months, had served more than 200. Going on, there has been a lot of talk about industrial land, whether areas wanting to have industrial and commercial development have the land capacity to do it. I want to show you something that we did in this current biennium, which is basically doing a quick survey of the 240 Oregon incorporated cities, finding out if one, they want industrial development, and two, if they want industrial development, if they have at least one marketable industrial site. I should emphasize that one marketable industrial site is not enough if a business is looking to locate, and chances are if the municipality says, you know, take the site or no site at all, it's probably not going to be an exact fit with what the business needs, but it's a starting point. And in addition,
if I may interrupt you, on the marketable industrial land, is that considered shovel ready?
This is not shovel ready,
okay.
Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
Okay.
The marketable industrial land is, we had a list of criteria which falls way short of shovel ready.
Okay.
Shovel ready definition basically means that you have infrastructure, water sewer hookup, it's ready to go. Many of the sites, as you know, have problems related to, for example, wetland and require mitigation or permitting. And so at this point, most of these so-called marketable industrial sites basically means that they are available on the market, but most of them do have barriers to get them to either a permit ready or a shovel ready. But the good news is about 49%, close to half of the Oregon municipalities do have at least one marketable industrial site. That gives us a beginning point to work with local jurisdictions and have more sites become available.
Once again, I'm sorry, but do we have an idea out of this pie, how many of the sites or what percentage of the sites would be shovel ready, or were shovel ready or permit ready backed out of the survey?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at this point we do not. But we are beginning to work with local jurisdictions to scrub this list further and identify areas where there is the greatest opportunity for industrial development, because in the recent past, last 2-3 years, somebody, a live customer, came and kicked tires and said, yeah, this looks pretty good in terms of what we're looking for. And we hope to be able to advance our understanding of sites that are of greater potential and merit further development, and we'll be working very closely with a number of other agencies in getting Oregon better ready for industrial development.
Okay, great, thank you. Representative Kitts.
How do you guys work with, like, LCDC? For example, I'm from Hillsboro, and we're screaming for more usable land out there. How do you guys work in conjunction with things like Metro and LCDC to approve? It seems like you're almost working against each other, you know, in the grand scheme of things. We want it. The land's there. Metro or LCDC doesn't define it as such, but you guys want to bring in these companies. So how do you work in conjunction with these other entities?
I think there are a couple ways to answer your question. One is short term and one is long term. In the short term, when a company comes in to look for a site and there is not land available, there is not a whole lot we can do about it, because, as you know, there is a local and regional process within the metro area, for example, to look at the urban growth boundary and potentially moving it or expanding it. And the state has some involvement, but certainly not at the local level directly. In the longer term, I think the news is better. We have been aware of the constraint, especially in select areas in the state. It's not just a metro problem. Bend, for example, has issues. There are a lot of municipalities with issues associated with the lack of industrial site. Hood River area, as I remember, have some issues as well with, for example, mill sites that could be converted, but they're outside of urban growth boundary, and so at this point would be out of reach. We have been working with LCDC and a number of other stakeholders, as directed by House Bill 3557, to look at, that's a bill that passed in the last last legislative session and directing a workforce, a task force to work together and come up with a recommendation. And so in that process, our department and LCDC staffed a task force, and the task force now has a list of recommendations which our department is looking at where it makes sense for us to take those recommendations and move them further. And I was talking earlier about working with local jurisdictions to help them with planning, with meeting Goal 9. As you know, Goal 9 has been on the books for a long time, but its implementation has been spotty across the state, and often it's because local jurisdictions don't have the capacity to deal with it. In addition, the lack of industrial and commercial land issue has, I think, gotten a lot of people's attention. When the economy is bad, the first thing that we realize is we don't have the infrastructure to support growth, even if businesses are interested in coming from out of state or expand from an Oregon business. And we just cannot push these companies out of state because we don't have the land available. So there is, at this point, idea of investing in highly probable sites and making them permit ready for certain types of use, for example, distribution or manufacturing, a certain type of manufacturing, and making them shovel ready, which means making further investment in infrastructure connections, road, water, sewer, etc. And it's not quite ready for us to say exactly how the program is going to be shaped up. But I can assure you that the governor's office has shown a very strong interest and is providing the leadership in coordinating these efforts. And when the governor shows an interest, I think agencies lined up a little bit better. And so we're very, very hopeful that we will be able to create a long-term and a short-term solution for this problem.
Will the chair grant me a follow-up?
I
don't think he answered my question exactly. My question specifically is do you guys, I understand the task force, but do you guys make recommendations? Because the infrastructure issues that you're talking about, for example, in Hillsborough, where I'm from, a lot of these infrastructures are in place, and the surrounding area is deemed not usable land by certain entities, and now that's arguable on both sides, and I understand that it's not the debate I want to have today. My question is do you guys, as the Economic Development Commission here, do you make recommendations to LCDC for the expansion of the UGB or not? Or do you just are your guys' hands tied by what they say?
Representative Kitts, Mr. Chair, our recommendation or our input to LCDC is not mandatory. It's not required. We have provided some input into the Metro UGB consideration process, but it's really advisory. And in that respect, and those processes, the department's voice and the commission's voice has no weight, no more weight than anyone else providing input. That's my understanding.
Okay. That's my question. Thank you.
Go ahead.
If I may direct your attention to page 12, there are a number of factors that we use to look at our internal efficiency, and cycle time is one of those. And very quickly, cycle time measures the number of days, which is internal to the department from moving a completed application to a signed contract. And as you see, that we track a number of cycle time from the initial application to a completed application, from application being complete to a funding decision, and then from the funding decision to a signed contract. And in all areas, we are seeing significant improvements. Clearly, we would like to continue to shorten the cycle time, but we're pleased with the progress that we have made. And the first chart shows the technical assistance type of projects, and then the second chart on page 13 shows construction cycle time for construction projects, which are more complex and you would expect would take slightly more time. The good news is we are pleased with the cycle time that we have seen since 01-02 for the last 18 months has been lower or shorter than the targets that we had set for ourselves. In fact, for our performance measure, the Economic and Community Development Commission sets the target annually and biannually for the agency against which we measure our work. If I may direct your attention to page 14, now we're looking at what the department has done in helping with job creation and retention. And you'll see that 0102, we far exceeded the annual target, and in the first 6 months of 0203, we are doing very well as well. And again, we show the target on the right-hand column. We show the total number of jobs that the department helped with either creating or retaining since 1997. On an annual basis, it does fluctuate. Part of it is because of the way we count these jobs, and part of it is because of the economy. In 0102, you will see the top bar, the dark bar, which is related to job retention, has accounted for a much higher percent of the total work that we have done. And that's a reflection of the times, and Freightliner being an example of the job retention that the state was involved in through our agency and other entities. We also measure the quality of these jobs. And so for the jobs where the department had a hand in either retaining or creating, we looked at what is the proposed wage and compare those jobs against the county average wage. And again, you will see that in the recent past, we have been exceeding the 50% mark, which is what our commission has set as a target.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mabry.
When we talk about jobs created, are we talking about direct job creation, or are we talking about the trickle down, the rollover of those jobs?
Representative Ray, Mr. Chair and the committee, we are talking about direct, not the indirect and induced.
Thank you.
But I should put in a caveat, which is these jobs are counted when the department enter into agreement with either a business or a local jurisdiction for financing a project or a need. And at that time, we would get the best estimate from the participant on what is the job impact. And we wrote it up and share with you what is the projected impact. Since July 1 of 01, the beginning of this biennium, we annually go back to the business and ask them what really happened. And so we are able to then share with you the actual result and compare that against the initial projection. Now, we are very new at this, so we don't have much data to show because, again, you'll remember even our short-term tools that in working with companies to retain or create jobs, usually it takes more than a year for the results to show. So right now we have very incomplete data, but we believe that data over time will become better and provide you with a better sense of just exactly what are the impact of these work that the department has been doing. If I may direct your attention to page 16, all of those infrastructure financing projects that we work on, they do get done. Eventually, on average, construction projects take 2 years, and planning, design, engineering projects take 2 years. So it's always many years after we have made an investment that these systems eventually complete. And then it's many years after these systems complete that eventually a business come in and occupy the facility and lead to jobs. So instead of measuring the results by jobs, these infrastructure projects are measured by just that they got done. And again, you'll see the results here. Now let me just walk you through very quickly what is our focus for 0305. And I think with all the background that I have shared with you, I can probably do this in an abbreviated fashion and not take away from this information. Our focus are three. The first one is to realign our internal efforts and resources, what our staff focus their energy on, and where we focus our funding on toward immediate job growth. there seemed to be a consensus that the economy is in great need of help, and our agency certainly is on the front line working with businesses, and we need to further focus our energy in areas where we can help with retaining jobs or creating jobs. The second thing is continuing investment in infrastructure to support business location and expansion. We talked a little bit about industrial lands. Certainly there is a lot of work that needs to be done to make industrial sites ready to go for business industrial occupation. And we have been investing infrastructure for a long time, and this is one area now we're beginning to look at and see where we can do some immediate good. And finally, improve accountability to ensure appropriate return. You know that there have been some concerns about the department's resources and the investment over time, and why does Oregon have a very high unemployment rate if the Economic Development Department is doing its job? I think the short answer is the economy is not just the influence or the results of what this department does or what the state does. Clearly, there are many other factors, including global resources and economy, that would have a profound impact in shaping Oregon's economy. On the other hand, that's not to say that we should not focus more of our attention in the accountability of our investments. And the example I offer you of checking back on the projected job creation or retention yearly and see what happened is one way of us making sure that we are getting good information and we are sharing good information with you. With that, I think the rest of the packet really expand beyond these three items more, and I'm not sure if you would like me to continue or we can, you know, pick up this conversation in another day. Basically, the department is looking at work we do that have an immediate impact on Oregon businesses and doing more of those things. And at the same time, we will continue with infrastructure investment, but in addition to what we have been financing traditionally, water sewer systems, etc., we are beginning to look at what is lacking in the business expansion of infrastructure. And industrial land clearly is one area that we are looking at adding to the infrastructure investment. And then finally, we want to be very sure about what these investments really mean in the long run, and are putting in more efforts to collect that information so we can provide you with more comprehensive and accurate and complete data over time.
Sherry, would you, because I noticed, as a matter of fact, I was going to bring up the issue about clustering, industrial clusters and that sort of thing, and one of them, of course, being the high-tech sector in the metropolitan area, and I see that you have Oregon Rains on here as well as Freightliner. Could you just, from a standpoint of retaining jobs and that sort of thing, could you just go ahead and hit on those couple things there, because it's that are on that page, because I think that's something that you know all of us have a major concern in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The information Chair Crummell referred to is on page 19. These are examples of how the department worked with Oregon business to help retain and grow jobs. Freightliner is an example of a major employer that has the challenges in its cost structure that has made the local operation less competitive, and corporate headquarters was considering a range of options, including leaving and moving the manufacturing facility elsewhere. And so in that instance, actually the ex-governor and the mayor of Portland and some of the staff from Portland Development Commission and our agency were involved in the meeting with the leadership of Freightliner, and they presented their dilemma to policymakers, and which then led to a package which the department staff actually went in working with the company representatives to figure out exactly what are the areas the state can and the city can provide some assistance and help make the proposal more competitive in order for corporate headquarters to look favorably upon keeping the Portland operation. As you know, in the end, this is public information, they did not keep the same manufacturing operation in Portland. Instead, they upgraded the facility. It is now manufacturing a different line of trucks, which is more competitive. It fits in the company's new strategies for the coming decade. And so we're happy that we're successful and we're able to retain thousands of jobs. But it did come at a cost, and of course, it doesn't guarantee that that this will last forever either. And I think that's really one of the challenges working in today's economy is the global competitive forces are constantly exerting the need for companies to evolve, innovate, and change and respond to those pressures. And very often, we, the state and public sector, gets caught in very late in the game, and when there are not a whole lot of options available. So that brings me to Oregon Rains as another example of proactive work. Oregon Rains stands for Regional Alliance for Information and Network Security. And it is a collaboration of many basically cybersecurity companies. It's mostly software development and marketing companies that sell the solutions to potential problems of cyber attack and creating better cybersecurity. The department sought an opportunity to help bring these companies together. As you know, Oregon is a very small business state, so we have a lot of small companies, but we don't have many medium-sized or large companies. And when a small company wants to seize the opportunity to get a federal contract or with a large company in cybersecurity, it doesn't have the ability to do so because it lacks marketing staff. It doesn't have the infrastructure, and basically everybody's already busy just to keep the company going. But there is strength in numbers, and the department convened meetings of these companies that are interested. They banded together and have found ways to work together, and in the end was able to get the support from, for example, Senator Wyden and Senator Smith, and they help a lot of these companies working together and through Oregon Rains to open the doors in Washington, D.C., and have direct contact with a good number of federal agencies, and has led to some contracts and procurements, and we're looking for additional research grants between these companies and higher ed institutions. We got them also hooked up and created a strong network. So that's basically one example of saying that as we work with these companies, we are creating as many opportunities as we can to work proactively. And so the next bullet that says call on 1,000-plus companies is what we plan to do, starting with our director and then all of our senior staff. They're out calling on companies on a regular basis, collecting information about how the company's doing and what are the areas where the company have significant challenges. And then that often will lead to assistance that we are able to provide, whether it's in business finance or with the regulatory permitting or help with international trade or in workforce areas. A lot of these are not what we can do directly, but because we have an extensive network, we can either refer the company onto other resources, or in many instances, we bring other agencies into the solution and help the company get past what it needs in order for them to be competitive and do better. And that's really what we do in retaining jobs and help create jobs.
And I think that's one of the things that maybe gets a little bit towards part of the answer that you were asking about, Representative Kitts, with regards to the regulatory permitting and that sort of thing, and how the department can be helpful to companies in terms of trying to sort of work through the maze that is out there for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may just offer one quick example, IMEX is a company that is located in Salem next to Yamasa soy sauce. And it's a Japanese company invested over $10 million in a plant here as their kind of a North America operation, manufacture toner cartridges. Is a very environmentally conscious company that recycle. I think it's one of the few companies that actually recycle toner cartridges. The site that they have picked is ideal for them, but it has a significant wetland. And the wetland mitigation between IMEX, a Japanese company with a totally different cultural experience with government, and then the Division of State Lands that has oversight over wetland permitting was not going very well. It was taking a long time. And one thing that we do is generally cut the amount of time it takes for the business to get to a decision so they can move ahead according to the schedule they need. And so our staff stepped in and basically helped both sides with the language so they had better understanding of what needs to be done, what could be done, and our department helped actually fashion a wetland mitigation package, which was to the satisfaction of both sides, and that basically led to groundbreaking many months before otherwise would have taken.
Okay, great. Does that kind of conclude where your comments? And I don't know, members, if you wanted to have her continue on in any of the. We've gone a little bit over time, but I think we're okay. If not, I do have a couple of things that I'd like you to just address, if you might, Sherry. One is, in the 2001 session, we passed a bill relative to microenterprise, and microenterprises are basically businesses that can get up and running for $35,000 or less. And maybe you could share a little bit of light on how that process is going. And then the other thing, and I know that you're familiar with is it Mr. Brooks, I think, in Portland, who operates the incubator out on, is it Vancouver Avenue in North Portland? And maybe you could talk a little bit about development, or if there has been any kind of development of incubators around the state.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, very quickly on the microenterprise bill. Yes, there was a bill passed, and there was no funds appropriated to support the program. And so the department worked with the proponent of the microenterprise program and used a very small portion of our small business assistance program to work a microenterprise network and kind of ran a pilot project. It's almost concluded now, and we're pleased with the result. On the Oregon Association
of
Minority.
Before you go on, with the microenterprise network, then, is that something that it looks like could work within the budget structure that the department currently has, or would there be a necessity in this session for the legislature to appropriate more funds into the microenterprise if that is coming through as it appears that it is or can be successful?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would say the microenterprise program at a full-fledged operation envisioned by the legislation is not something that the department could finance within our current resources. However, I had mentioned the pilot effort was successful, and certainly it is something that would be helpful for that small subset of small businesses. So again, I think it depends on the legislative direction and priorities. In terms of incubators, Oregon is not known for its incubator investment. There are two kinds of incubators in Oregon. One is the hard asset incubator, so their infrastructure buildings build out with basically what small businesses would need, and they go in there into the hard facility, and the Northeast Portland facility is one such incubator where they focus quite a bit on food processing, food manufacturing, value-added products, kind of operation. Another kind of incubator that's run out of Central Oregon, for example, is a virtual incubator. And in that area, they excel in working with entrepreneurs and really help support the idea formation as well as taking an idea on to fruition in more kind of the knowledge area as opposed to the hard bricks and mortar type of enterprise. And I would say both are fairly successful given their narrower focus, but Oregon is not known for its incubator investment compared to many other parts of the state. Having said that, there are a number of efforts, selected efforts now, that are kind of along the areas of incubators and focusing more specifically on certain area of business. For example, the biotech initiative of Oregon Health and Sciences University has now expanded to include hard facility development along the lines of incubators for spin-off of the research ideas from campus onto commercial sector. And so I think it may not be, the general consensus is it may not be wise to develop incubators for incubators' sake, but where there is a focused effort to develop certain type of businesses and where there is technology that is ripe for further commercialization, development of incubator facilities certainly then would make sense. And I think University of Oregon has been fairly successful with its incubator office campus, basically focusing on medical equipment technology with a great deal of success. And in those instances, it's because the startup need specific facilities with air handling equipment, which may be very expensive, and it's so specialized. It's not the kind of place that a startup can just go into an office building and try to retrofit that building in order for it to be able to have the right facility for the commercialization of ideas. And in those instances, it seemed to make a lot of sense, and we're kind of watching the development of the McAdam facility with a great deal of interest.
Thank you. Are there other questions for Sherry, Representative Mabry?
Just one. Is there any direct connection with OECDD and the small business development
centers
that are around the state? And I'm not even sure. I know in our county that's connected to the community college. I'm not sure they are. Maybe they are all over the state. But is there any direct connection?
Representative Mabry, Mr. Chair. There is a direct connection, and that's through funding.
Okay.
The department's small business assistance funds, the majority of it goes to the statewide Small Business Development Center network, of which there are 19. 16 of them are housed in community colleges. The rest are housed on university grounds. And we are concerned, and we're actually wrestling with the budget problems of community colleges affecting their funding for small business development centers, which is one of our mainstay for delivering services to small businesses. At this point, I don't think we know enough, but we do know our current service delivery structure through small business development centers probably will have to change depending on eventually what happens with the community college funding support. These centers basically get about a quarter of their money from our department, a quarter of the money from Small Business Administration, which is the federal funding source, and then roughly half of that money from community colleges. So when that half is in question, it makes us really uneasy.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there other questions for Sherry? Sherry, I would like to thank you very much for coming down and sharing the information with us. I also, members, would encourage you and also our other colleagues in the House and Senate to look at the annual report and also to, I believe that there was an audit done by the Secretary of State's office. Was it last year?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there was an audit on the department's performance April 2001.
Okay.
And the department during the course of the interim had reported to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee mm-hmm. on our progress. We have done a corrective action plan, and we have been well on track in carrying out all of the work. And the Joint Legislative Audit Committee was pleased with our all the action that we have taken. Certainly, I will be happy to provide any additional information to members of the committee if you're interested in the specifics of what we have done.
Thank you. I would encourage you, what I wanted to do is encourage you all to look at the Secretary of State's audit website so you can look at the audit, and then I don't know if they're putting the follow-up information on as far as a corrective action plan or if that's on the OECDD website, but it's one of the two, I'm sure.
It's Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that information is in the records, and I'd be happy to provide that information to you in the records of legislative committee.
Okay. If you could point us to a website that we can go to, that'd be terrific, and that sort of thing, I would appreciate it. Sherry, thank you again.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the information hearing from OECDD. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2548. And Representative Close is here to talk to us about this bill. Representative, welcome to House General Counsel.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here with you. Thank you for working with us on getting the testimony. What I'm handing out to you, I'm Representative Betsy Close from House District 15, and I'm handing out testimony that was in the Democrat Herald last night that explains how this bill came to be. So thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. This bill came out of a situation way back in November 2001, it's been over a year, where an Albany woman wanted to erect a community flag at the intersection of 9th Avenue, Pacific Boulevard, and Sanium Highway. This is a couplet situation where three major highways come together. So they've done landscaping in this project. There's walkways through it. There's flowers planted, annuals. So it's not just the side of the road. This is a couplet. And that's where they wanted to place this flag. American Legion Post 10 in our area had agreed to purchase the pole, and it was a 40-foot flag pole. The concrete was to be donated by a local concrete person, Harry Miller. And American Legion was going to be involved purchasing a large flag and maintaining the area. And they asked for donations from the community. Then just a few days... Well, actually, 6 months later, then in June 2002, Becky Parker, who this idea was, she had collected the money, American Legion had collected the money. They had to abandon the idea of the community flagpole at the couplet because ODOT had said that their agency rules did not permit items such as flags, signs, or advertisement in its right-of-way. It's considered a right-of-way. They are quoted as saying, because under guarantees of free speech, we can't distinguish between an appropriate or an inappropriate item. If we allow an American flag, we might have to allow a Taliban flag. ODOT's developed a policy that you can't put anything in the right-of-way, and that was Bruce Erickson, project leader for the ODOT Area 4 area. So anyway, the city looked into getting around the regulation by doing it on their own property. So it's sort of a work in process. But I felt that we needed to clarify that in the rules of ODOT, and I thought that it should be appropriate for there to be an American flag and an Oregon state flag. So what this bill does is to specify that if a fee is paid, that ODOT can allow the display of the United States flag or the Oregon state flag. And they can establish standards for the placement so they can make sure that it isn't, 2 feet off the side of the road or something. We wouldn't want to mandate that they would have to allow anything, just these items, and that they could determine placement and work with those who would basically raise private money to do so.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for Representative Plus?
I'd like to make one more comment, if I could, Mr.
Please.
Chair. ODOT is, I've talked to them, and they're going to testify about a loss in California where Caltrans was sued over this very issue and lost in a federal court there. If we did pass this, we could face a lawsuit, but I think that through the legal system, we might be able to assure that our citizens still had this right, at least in Oregon, even though they haven't been able to do so in California. So that is something that you will hear testimony on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got Doug Tyndall from the Oregon Department of Transportation. And then we have H.A. McDonald will be on deck, and Andrea Meyer is in the hole, as they say in baseball talk. Spring training is upon us.
Yes, it is. Chair Cromwell, members of the committee, I'm Doug Tyndall. I'm the state maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I appreciate Representative Close giving my testimony for me. She did it pretty accurately. I wanted to tell the committee we're not here to oppose this bill. We just felt that it was important that the committee understood something that we knew had happened in California. And as Representative Close indicated, Caltrans permitted a display of a United States flag on the right-of-way. Subsequently, there was a request to put up another flag that carried somewhat of an anti-American message. They denied a permit to do that and were sued in federal district court on United States constitutional freedom of speech rights. And the court found in favor of the defendant and not instructed Caltrans to remove the American flags, but rather that if they were going to allow American flags, they had to allow other political statements. Caltrans chose to remove the U.S. flag and go back to not allowing anything, which is essentially the current practice in Oregon. So not intending to stop this bill, just wanted to make the committee aware of what had happened in a neighboring state. And with that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Tyndall? Doug, I do have a question. The way that the bill is, and I don't know how the California bill was worded, but the way that this bill is worded, it states specifically the United States flag or the Oregon State flag. Do you see that as creating and then a fee for the permit to do it? Do you see that as being a little bit more of a safeguard from a standpoint of the federal courts, or
Chair Cromwell? I'm not as much as I like to try and practice it occasionally to the chagrin of the AG's office. I'm not a lawyer, so I really can't say whether or not putting this into law. I don't know what vis-a-vis the Constitution, what impact the state law would have on the Constitution, and whether that makes any difference or not. My understanding in California is they did not have a law; it was just a permit that was issued by Caltrans. I don't know that there was a specific law that allowed that or directed them to do that.
Okay. Yeah, that was just kind of the question that I was. Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Tyndall? Doug, thank you. Let's see. Mr. McDonald? And then Andrea Meyer is on deck.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Matt McDonald. I represent the Disabled American Veterans, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Military Order of World Wars, and the Salem Area Veterans. We are not opposed to this bill in any way, but we do question who is going to take care of these flags once weather or they're ripped or something like that. Because as you go around the state, you see memorials that people have put out, and they seem to be abandoned because they put plastic flowers and they've changed colors, or they put up things and it just, they're abandoned after the period of time. We'd like to see something in the bill with the Department of Transportation, if the flags are worn or torn, that they need to be taken down, or the people responsible notified. But something should happen so Foreign people come into this country, don't see an American flag that's desecrated, or citizens of the state don't see flags that are desecrated.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. McDonald? Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
And Andrea Meyer.
Good morning, Chair Crumbull, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. I'm sorry, I don't know baseball that well, but I picked up that references were two. So I guess I'm up at bat now. Would be
yes,
the,
you are. You
okay.
are up to bat now.
Anyway, the ACLU of Oregon is concerned about this bill because, in our opinion, what it does is it opens up the door to require and allow all speech, all display of symbols and items to be then put up in the public right away. You can't limit it to one type of speech, one position, or one particular type of display in terms of content, and then not allow everyone else to have the same access. So it's kind of either all or it's nothing. And we certainly don't have a position if you want to do all or do nothing. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kitts.
I don't know if you're able to answer the question. Maybe Mr. Brzezinski can. He's an attorney. The California Department of Transportation, in their suit, lost. Now, if they found it unconstitutional to do that, just because we put it in law here with parameters, would that not... would it still be deemed, our law would just then be unconstitutional as opposed to the act of California? Am I understanding that correctly?
Chair Crummell, Representative Kitts, you are. The Oregon Constitution, as well as the federal, would trump Oregon law in this case. So it's, even if it's within the parameters of simply the Oregon state flag and the United States flag, and the law is constrained in that manner, the Oregon Constitution will trump it. And the free expression provision, and the way that's been interpreted is the open forum or the closed forum sort of aspects to it. It's a closed forum right now, and you're opening it up. And so that would be the constitutional analysis. And
sure.
Certainly let Representative Przanski
chime. What's to be said?
Right, yeah.
Follow-up? Sure.
You'd have to amend the Oregon Constitution in some manner, and then I'm not even sure in terms of the federal constitution trumping that in terms of the restrictions.
For my follow-up, I just want to, for the record, I passed out flag etiquette, as Mr. McDonald testified to earlier, and I would encourage the committee to look through the flag etiquette and look at respect to our veterans and to people that have served that very flag in war, what is required to honor the flag when it's to be taken down and in the fashion in which it's to be disregarded. It's a ceremonial thing, and it's very specific here, and I think that's something we have to take into consideration is who would perform these functions and at what point, and if they did not, what is the penalty? So I would reiterate, Mr. McDonald, and I, again, am not opposed to posting our flag anywhere. In fact, I think it should be a requirement. However, I understand I don't think that Oregon in our budget crisis can afford any more lawsuits. So that's my 2 cents. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mabry?
I do have a question in regards to this building. I think we have a United States and an Oregon flag flying on this building. This, too, is subject to the Al-Qaeda flag flying if someone requested that.
Chair Crummell, Representative Mabry, I was sitting back there. I was contemplating that we do allow flags up in public buildings. And I guess the way I'd answer that is, however, we have a public forum related to this building as well. And that's the front steps of the Capitol. And people can go there and communicate to the head of the government their position about these things and on the street. And there is, I haven't looked at the case law to, obviously you're pointing out one of the interesting aspects of the flags that are flown on front of courthouses and on state capitals. And that does not create a public forum right there on the top of the capitol. But I think this in front of the courthouses, in front of the state capitals are public forums, and there's an opportunity to communicate your message as well and to come in and testify.
So it becomes more of the issue of where the forum is created. In the instance that Representative Close talked about, it's an intersection in Albany that happens to have State Highway, and the bill would call for a permit fee. I guess two things. One is that because of its proximity to the highways or the intersection that the Albany instance is referring to, is that different, do you think, than, say, for example, somebody saying that they wanted to pay a $25 fee and plant a flag along I-5? Also, I guess the other question is, does the $25 fee create a sufficient enough barrier that, and I don't know if I'm stating that correctly or not, but create a sufficient enough barrier that only somebody that was really serious about wanting to display something along I-5 being able to pay the fee and be able to display their whatever it is they wanted to display?
Chair Crummell, to go to your second question first, you know, I'm not sure if a $25 fee would hold up if you're if it's reasonable and you're creating a public forum so that anyone can come put up anything. Whether a permit process may be feasible, however, I think if your concern is, again, I think you can't do it a $25 fee for simply the American and Oregon flags. It would have to be a $25 fee for any, you know, communication that you want to have, period, whether it's a peace symbol, an American flag, a flag of another country, a Canadian flag. And it's not just limited by saying flags in here. This does not, I believe the constitutional analysis would not solely restrict it to other flags. It would be any other symbols or forms of speech or expression in support of. It could be Go Blazers, or I would use a baseball analogy, but I don't know the teams, and I know we don't have one in Oregon.
Not yet.
So the $25 fee, whether that would be permissible or not, is irrelevant to at least our position of that it would have to be open to everyone. Your first question in terms of the proximity to the highway versus sort of one that's right on I-5, we wouldn't distinguish. These are not these right-of-way areas, these on-ramp areas are not public forums. People don't come gather, and you can't put up other displays. I understand it's landscaped, and it's nice, and I, you know, that's great. I wish we could simply do that to all. But the fact that it's landscaped and made more aesthetic does not make it a public community forum to go to, and unless you decide to do that and create that as a park where people can have access to it, and then I think I have a feeling you have issues of safety and public safety coming into boot, because I don't think it's a public park.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kipps.
Is there nothing, and this is just an inquiry, is there nothing that states whether or not we could erect some sort of a memorial, say, let's say you wanted to put a flag out for a specific reason? Is there not anything in statute currently that says that you couldn't apply for the permit to do a memorial type thing with a plaque, maybe, you know, this site in remembrance of blah, 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 whatever you want to say, with a flag as the is there nothing in statute that allows, I mean, you see these memorials all over, be it a cow downtown Portland with these cows that they're selling, or a plaque on the ground or whatever. Is there nothing in statute that says you cannot do that currently if you wanted to accomplish this, go by means of that avenue?
I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not a lawyer either.
Well, I don't know if ODOT can you kind of speak to.
Yeah, Doug, maybe Doug knows her.
And there's actually the statutes, if I could, just where it talks about notwithstanding Section 1 on line 4, subparagraph 1, notwithstanding provisions in 377.700 through 377.840. You may want to look at that because it actually sets out some parameters. And then also, there's also in Section 2, 810.200 through 810.210, talking about highway signs and postage. So there are some ramifications, some parameters that have been contemplated.
Great. Thank you.
Doug, can you...
Chair Kremel, again, Doug Tindall, Oregon Department of Transportation. Chair Kremel, Representative Kitts, the only... program that I can think of offhand where we do plaques, there's in rest areas, not on operating right away, but in some of the rest areas are designated as Blue Star Memorial rest areas. And I'm not sure, I know the statutory designation for that, but it's a small plaque that's in those, in a few rest areas, or not a few, there's actually several rest areas, that is a memorial to all veterans.
Okay.
And maintained by garden clubs, I believe.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mabry?
I'm stuck on this right-of-way thing and who can and who can't. And I'm thinking in terms of driving down the freeway, I see, you know, signs for McDonald's and signs for motels and signs for service stations. And if I'm one of those three retail establishments, I can buy space on that sign, but I can't buy space for John Mabry's mortuary or John Mabry's grocery store or John Mabry's anything unless I fit those categories. And so, you know, here we're talking about a category, in my mind, of United States or Oregon State flag. How's that different than a category for fast food restaurants?
Representative Kremel, Representative Mabry, good question. Signs that you refer to are called motor service signs. They are specifically allowed by the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, which Oregon has adopted. It's a federal standard. It's actually more than a federal standard. It's adopted in many other countries, too, that tells you the color of the stripe on a one-lane road and the color of a stripe on a two-lane or a one-way road and a two-way road. It tells you just tons of things. It's a very thick document that describes signing. In there, it specifically allows what are called motorist service signing, and that's why that's allowed. Why that's not considered a public forum, I'm not positive, although there is very prescriptive about what that sign can look like, and it can't be come visit Judge Mabry's mortuary. It just can say that it exists at the next exit.
Thank you.
You can't say Mabry's gas station.
Yeah. And mortuary.
I think Representative Carmel Chuck Carmel, Representative Mabry, you want to get someone with property adjacent to the freeway. That's the trick.
Are there any other questions for our witnesses? Great. Thank you very much, both. I appreciate it. I think what I would like to do is, I think the Mr. McDonald brought up a very interesting point with regards to maintenance of the flag. And rather than taking this into, and I think Representative Kitts brought up relative issues with regards to etiquette, I'm going to just ask Representative Close to kind of look into these particular issues, and rather than taking the bill to a work session now, to kind of look into a couple of these issues and see if it's something that would be I guess advisable for us to move in a direction, and I think the idea of an amendment relative to maintenance of the flag is something that ought to be looked at as well. So I'll ask Representative Close to look into that, and then this bill may come back to us at some point in the future, but at this point I think we'll not take it into a work session. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2548. Members, thank you very much for being here. We will look forward to seeing you on Thursday, I believe, and we will have another stimulating something going on. So with that, we will stand adjourned.